This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Carnivore Club. How would you like to have delicious, cured, and smoked meat sent to your door directly once a month? Well, thanks to Carnivore Club, that dream can come true. Carnivore Club searches the country far and wide for the best smoked and cured meats. You're going to get stuff like boar salami, spicy pork chorizo, venison jerky, all sorts of amazing stuff, and it changes once a month. This will make a great Father's Day gift that's coming up next June. If you want to try Carnivore Club at a discount, go to carnivoreclub.co and use promo code AOM at checkout for 10% off. Again, that's carnivoreclub.co and use promo code AOM at checkout for 10% off. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So you're probably familiar with the battles of World War II fought in the European and Pacific theaters thanks to shows like Band of Brothers or Pacific on HBO. But what a lot of people don't know is that there was a part of World War II that was fought just off the coast of the United States. And the thing was, it was between civilians and the German U-boats. And my guest today on the podcast has written a book about this often forgotten part of World War II history. His name is William Giroux. He's the author of the book, The Matthews Men, Seven Brothers in the War Against Hitler's U-Boats. And it's about the war fought between the U.S. Merchant Marine and Hitler's U-Boats that often happened, like I said, right off the coast of the United States. What a lot of people don't know is that the merchant mariners, they were civilians. They weren't actually soldiers, but they had some of the highest casualty rates during World War II as they were shipping supplies to soldiers across the war. And they even got involved in the war before the U.S., were in the war as they were shipping supplies to Great Britain, our ally. A really fascinating podcast. We also get into the title of the book, The Matthews Men, because as we'll see, there was this county in Virginia that supplied a huge amount of the merchant mariners that took part in World War II. In fact, one family, there was eight members, male members of the family that were merchant mariners. We'll discuss what life was like as a merchant mariner, what life was like as a U-boat, not very pleasant. And yeah, you'll have a lot of cocktail party campfire fodder after this show. And just to give you a heads up, my connection with my guest on Skype was a little spotty when I was doing the interview. So there is a little bumpy noise to the podcast. We've done our best to edit it as possible to clean it up. But just to give you a heads up about that. And to let you know also, I'm about to release and about to be able to do recordings with a platform that I developed that will allow me to do remote recordings, remote interviews, while maintaining pristine audio quality. I'm really excited about it, and hopefully it'll up the podcast up even more. So appreciate your support and your patience. And when you're done listening to the show, make sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/Matthews, and that's one T, not two. William Giroux, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so your book is called The Matthews Men, and it's about the U.S. Merchant Marine during World War II. In this war that they had with German U-boats that happened really close to the United States, and it's something that a lot of people don't know about. But before we get into that, let's talk about the Merchant Marine itself, because I think a lot of people have heard of it, the Merchant Marine, but don't know exactly what they did or what they do. So what is the U.S. Merchant Marine, and why do we not really know much? Why does the public not know much about it?
Well, they don't know much about it, and the part of the reason is the Merchant Marine is really now is just a shadow of what it once was. So it's not very much in the public eye anymore. But the Merchant Marine, it's the name is confusing. It sounds like a branch of the military, but it's not. It's really sort of a loosely organized group of civilians, private citizens, mariners who sail ships normally for commercial purposes, you know, hauling cargo. But in World War II, and really in any times of war throughout the history of the United States, the Merchant Marine really, you know, becomes sort of an adjunct to the military. It hauls war supplies. It's the supply line. And in World War II, that was very important. It was they hauled everything that the Allied troops needed to survive and fight in foreign battlefields. I mean, everything from fuel to guns, ammunition, planes, tanks, jeeps, trucks, food, bug repellent, medical supplies, everything. They were the supply line.
And this is where, this is why they were such big targets for the Germans during World War II.
Yes, the U-boats, their mission was to try to cut that supply line, because the Germans knew that if America could project its industrial power across the ocean, the Germans were doomed. They weren't going to, the Third Reich was not going to survive it. So the U-boats were their way of, that was really the most effective part of the German Navy, was the U-boats, and that was their mission, to cut the supply line if they could.
Well, yeah, and that was another interesting thing. I mean, I've heard of German U-boats, but I didn't really know much about them, except that they were sort of submarines, but sort of not. I mean, what exactly is a U-boat? Because it's not, it can go underwater, but it's technically not a submarine.
Correct. It's not a submarine the way we think of submarines today, the nuclear subs, the big ones that can stay underwater for months at a time without even communicating with the outside world. The U-boats were, diving vessels. They performed much better on the surface, but they were able to submerge for brief periods of time to conduct attacks or to try to escape pursuers. And there's sort of a mystique about U-boats, that they were these, you know, the ultimate weapons. But one of the things I try to do in the book is to show that they really had a lot of weaknesses and vulnerabilities. They were slower than a lot of the, you know, most of the warships that hunted them. And if they got driven underwater, if they were located by sonar or radar and driven underwater to try to escape, they were pretty helpless. And they were dependent on the wiles, the trickery of the U-boat commander to try to outwit their pursuers and figure out a way to get away from them. And if they didn't, the U-boat would be destroyed, often by depth charges, and sent to the bottom, often with all hands.
Right. I guess you mentioned in the book that U-boats had some of the highest casualties during the war.
Yes. Once the Allies figured out or got the technology and the tactics and the experience to deal with them and really were able to go after them, the predators, the U-boats, quickly became the prey. And by the end of the war, it was a suicide mission, basically, to go out in a U-boat. They were hunted. Their effectiveness was completely gone, so much so that the head of the U-boat command, Admiral Karl Dönitz, considered at one point just pulling them out of the war zones because they were just getting slaughtered. But he ultimately decided that if they did that, the Allies were devoting a great deal of people and weaponry to control them. And if they were gone, the Allies could apply that weaponry elsewhere. So they kept them in the field, basically to occupy the enemy, and at enormous losses to themselves.
And yeah, you describe life on a U-boat, and it sounded absolutely horrible. Like, it was like, I don't know why anyone would want to sign up to be a member on a U-boat.
It was brutal. I mean, the air was foul, the food was often rancid, the U-boat was so cramped that the men literally slept on torpedoes that were stored under their bunks, and all the U-boat's operating systems were so exacting, so demanding, that everything had to be done, to a certain way, a certain sequence, and any deviation from that could doom the U-boat, and that even extended to the U-boat's toilets. And if there's at least one example that I describe in the book where an improperly flushed toilet ended up sinking a U-boat.
Yeah, I thought that was I mean, it was funny in a sad way. So this is, the U-boats, part of the mission early on in the war, even before America was, officially in the war, the U.S. Merchant Marine started engaging with these U-boats. So what was the U.S. Merchant Marine's role in World War II, even before the United States had actually officially declared war?
Well, the British were suffering terrible losses from the U-boat. Of course, Britain is an island nation, and they depend on shipping to supply everything. And the U-boats were really hurting them. They were sinking British merchant ships and killing British mariners faster than they could be replaced. So Winston Churchill asked President Franklin Roosevelt for help, and Roosevelt found different ways, short of being in a war, to help them. And one of those ways was using the mobilizing the Merchant Marine, the U.S. Merchant Marine, to deliver goods to the British. And at the beginning of the war, Hitler, or when he was first approaching the war, he wasn't in that big of a hurry for us to join the war. He had invaded Russia, and he really had a lot of, had all the enemies he really, more enemies really than he could use at that point. So he was, even though it was clear to everybody, and particularly the U-boat commanders, I mean, they had to look through their periscopes at these American ships and see them delivering, basically breaking their blockade, and not be able to do anything about it for political reasons, because Hitler said, do not sink American ships yet. We'll suffer the consequences of letting them deliver supplies. And so this went on for quite some time, but America got, more and more into it, and pretty soon our warships were helping to escort the big convoys across the North Atlantic, and the U-boats started sinking some of our ships, some of our, a destroyer and a number of merchant ships. And at first Hitler would apologize, he'd say, oh, it was a mistake. But after a while, he just quit bothering to apologize. And we were just slowly getting further into the war before we were actually in it. And for some people, the people that lived on the East Coast, it was a surprise that we got into the war because of something that happened in the Pacific rather than what was going on in the Atlantic, because it was clear that we were moving ever close to it. And the merchant mariners were on the front lines of the European war for months before we had, troops in the fields against the Germans. They were the front lines for, a lot of 1942.
And again, they weren't actually members of the military. They were civilians, right? And they were facing the brunt of this unofficial war the U.S. had entered against Germany by being an ally of Great Britain.
Yes, and they were really the tip of the spear, although they really didn't have much of a spear, most of these merchant ships were, a lot of them at the beginning of the war, they were old. They'd been built during World War One, and they were slow. They were ploddingly slow. They were, a lot of them were overloaded with stuff that they were never designed to carry, and they were pretty much unprotected. They were sent out on the hope that they would get where they were going without encountering a U-boat, because if they did, they were sitting ducks. And so this went on for quite some time. Some of the ships were armed with, the Navy would install gun tubs on these merchant ships, and they put Navy gun crews on there to man them. But through no fault of these gun crews, putting a gun tub on a merchant ship was not a good way to protect it from U-boats. And a lot of these Navy gunners died right alongside the merchant mariners when ships were torpedoed. There's no record of a Navy gun crew ever sinking a U-boat.
So at what point did the Germans start sending U-boats into U.S. water? This was the thing that was really surprising to me, because we often think, the war really didn't come to America. It was fought in the Pacific and Europe. But the German U-boats, they got really, really close to America during World War II. And so at what point did the Germans start swarming U-boats near American coast?
The first ones came here in early January, the second week in January. Five of them came here, and they, Dönitz, the German, the head of the German U-boat command, wanted to send a lot more, but he was, Hitler and some of his superiors in the German Navy didn't want to send that money. The Germans didn't have nearly as many U-boats as they wanted, and Hitler thought they should be deployed here and there, and it sort of frustrated Dönitz, because he knew that he was a master of his great gift was to constantly be shifting the U-boats around into the whatever the weakest point in the Allied supply line was. He kept close track of this. He monitored it. And right after America got into the war, the weakest point by far was the coast of the United States. He wanted to put a lot more here. But anyway, they came here in early January and just ran roughshod. I mean, they were sinking a ship a day. And then, but they could only stay for so long. They could only stay for a couple of weeks, and they'd run out of fuel, run out of torpedoes. So he would send another wave of them. So he kept really just sending waves of U-boats, and they'd stay here a couple of weeks and sink a bunch of ships, and then they'd go back, and a new group would come, and they ranged from five to maybe a little over a dozen, over the course of the first year of the war, when they were really effective before we started protecting the mariners with convoys and started defending our coastline.
And I mean, what was surprising is like how close they got. I mean, you describe how there would be members of the U-boat, they'd come to the surface and they'd get out and they could see like the skyline of New York City or see the Ferris wheel at Coney Island. I mean, they were that close.
Yeah,
they
were. I mean, they would be within, there's a sunken U-boat less than 20 miles off the coast of, closer to 15 miles off the coast of Nags Head, North Carolina, on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, which is a big tourist community. And the U-boats, they sank, they torpedoed ships right within sight of the beach at Jupiter Inlet, Florida. They torpedoed ships right near the mouth of the Mississippi River. And in the summer of 42, they even got close enough to land teams of would-be saboteurs on the United States. So they got close enough to send these guys in a raft to the beach and to go ashore with the idea that they were going to find a factory to destroy or something. So they were right here. And there was a lot, at the time, there was a lot of, once it became clear that these U-boats were close, there was a lot of worry in some of these coastal communities and rumors that, strange lights on the beach at night, or, there were stories, all of them bogus, about, strange men's bodies being found with, German, stuff in their pocket that identified them as U-boats. But most of those stories were just not true. But it was sort of a paranoia right along in some of these isolated beach communities.
But you said that the Germans ran roughshod over American ships, the merchant marine ships. And it happened for a long time. And why did it take so long for the U.S. to really do anything about the U-boats that were sinking ships off American coasts?
Well, part of it was unavoidable. The United States was not, despite this buildup, we weren't really prepared for the war when it, when it came upon us, and we didn't have a lot of ships and planes to use to patrol our coasts. We had, we were fighting the Japanese in the Pacific, and we were helping with these big convoys that would leave, on a very regular basis from Maritime Canada to Britain. And those were still going on, and they needed protection. But we did have some ships and planes, but the Admiral Ernest King, who had really operational control of the Navy, was hesitant to deploy what we did have to protect the ships along the coast. And he was just very reluctant to do this. And one of the reasons, I mean, he did think about it, but he felt that he had an idea that once we built enough new warships and planes that we could, have these really powerful, effective convoys, a convoy being, a ring, basically a ring of warships and an air cover of planes protecting these helpless merchant ships. And once we had enough of those that we could run convoys, then we'd run a really good convoy system. Eventually we did. But before that, he was reluctant to run a weak convoy system. He didn't want to send a convoy out with just a few ships that weren't well armed, because his thinking was, if we did that, we're just making the U-boat's job easier. We're just assembling all the targets for them in one place, and then we can't protect them. But that really wasn't true, and the British had already learned this. The British had learned that any protection at all was better than nothing. And in particular, in the United States, the only reason the Germans were sending U-boats 3,000 miles across the ocean, U-boats were precious. You know, they needed all they could get. The only reason they were willing to send them this far, the only reason it made sense, is that the kills over here were so easy. You know, they could, if they were in an unprotected stretch of ocean, U-boats could just, they were ship sinking machines. They could sink one ship after another. But so anything we had done in those early months to make it even a little bit more difficult for them to sink merchant ships would have compelled the Germans to, you know, to recalculate the costs and benefits of sending these U-boats all the way over here. So this went on for quite a long time, and finally Admiral King got the, and he was criticized during this time. The British were complaining, you know, why are you letting all these ships be torpedoed? A lot of the ships were ultimately on their way to Britain, and the different people in the military, the U.S. military, were noticing this, and they're saying, this can't go on. Can't you do something? And he kept saying, you know, we're doing all we can. We'll get to it. And finally, in about maybe August of 1942, the convoy system started to take shape, and the torpedoings of merchant ships just dropped immediately. I mean, the numbers just plummeted. And it took a little while for the convoy. There were still a few bugs in it, or a lot of bugs in the system and areas that weren't covered. But after August of 1942, things got better and better. And by the spring of 1943, the Allies had figured out they had what they needed to really defeat the U-boats, and that was really when the tide turned in the U-boat war.
I guess they developed new technology, microwave sonar. Was it microwave?
Microwave radar that could be carried in planes. Prior to that, a U-boat at night a U-boat commander could surface and they'd recharge the U-boat's batteries in cloudy weather, they didn't have to worry about being spotted by a plane. But once the planes had radar, they could just, you know, appear without warning out of the clouds in the middle of the night and strike a U-boat on the surface. And the U-boats were not able to detect the planes quickly enough to avoid them. So that was when the U-boats started to become sitting ducks. We also had different ships. We had destroyer escorts. We started, the American shipyards were just cranking these things out, and they were ideal for hunting U-boats. And we had little escort carriers, little miniature aircraft carriers that could, they had enough planes that they could be like floating airfields and just sail in the middle of convoys and provide air cover as the convoy moved, you know, through the ocean. And that was a great advantage because the U-boats, it made it very difficult for the U-boats to do anything. They had to, any time a plane came by, they had to dive because it took them a while to crash dive. The plane was faster. So, they had hunter-killer groups. They had groups that were specifically designed. Their only job was to sink U-boats. And those groups, it was an escort carrier, a group of destroyers. And when they found a U-boat, they could simply sit over it and drop depth charges until they sank it. So there was no escape. The U-boat commanders had a hard time outwitting those guys because the killer groups didn't have anything. That was their only job, was to sink U-boats, and they sank a lot of them.
So you mentioned that, you know, the U-boats would torpedo these merchant marine ships. And of course, there were casualties, but there were typically survivors. And people were able to get off the boat before it sank. What happened to the mariners after they were, these surviving mariners, after they were torpedoed?
Well, they would go home or make it home, and they would go right back out on, many of them would go right back out on other ships. They had 30 days, basically, at the end of the voyage to sign on with another merchant ship. And if they didn't do that, they became eligible for the draft. And, some of these guys, they simply didn't want to be in the infantry. They didn't want to be in the army or in the foxholes. But for other men, they were patriotic. They wanted to serve their country, and they were mariners. That's what they did. That was their life. And they were, so if they could serve there, and the nation needed these guys, it needed them badly. So they would sign on again, even though they knew. And I don't think when they got more started, I don't think they realized how dangerous it would be. But certainly by a few months in, everybody that signed on to a ship knew that it was a very dangerous business. A lot of these guys, you know, just went out there again and again. There was one guy that kept torpedoed 10 times over the course of the two world wars, because it's even less known that the Germans sent U-boats to American shores in World War One as well.
Wow. And so, yeah, I mean, they were able to get back because I guess they would to get on survival rafts or lifeboats. And what I thought was interesting is that the U-boats would often, you know, they'd come to the surface and they would talk to the merchant marine very like, oh, you know, it's war. You know, we didn't, no hard feelings against you, but this is war, you understand. And they'd hand off, you need any cigarettes? You need any whiskey? You need any food? I mean, I thought that was just, it was interesting that they'd had these conversations with the Germans after they got their ship sunk.
It was. And to me, I think that was really one of the most surprising things that I discovered doing research on the book. And there were numerous encounters like this. And it really depended on the character of the U-boat commander. Some of the U-boat commanders were utterly ruthless. You know, they'd sink a ship and leave the guys out there to the, you know, to the mercy of the sea, which often was no mercy at all. But other ones, and if you look at the reports in the National Archives, you can track and you can see which commanders were not that way, which commanders were, their conscience bothered them. They didn't want to leave these guys out there. Some of the U-boat commanders had been merchant mariners before the war, and they were dedicated to sinking these guys' ships. That's what they were doing. But once you had men that were, you know, their ship was sunk, they were helpless, they were on a raft, and a lifeboat, some of these commanders, they just couldn't bring themselves to leave them there to die without offering them some help. And that was directly against the orders of Hitler and the U-boat command. Hitler thought they should basically machine gun these guys in the lifeboats, or do what, kill them somehow, because to him, it was not just a matter of sinking ships, but getting rid of these mariners. And he figured, well, if we kill enough of them, then they'll stop sailing. And Dönitz, the head of the U-boat commander, man, was a little less cold-blooded, but he told these guys over and over again, do not help castaways. Do not help these guys in the lifeboat. You don't have to, you know, go out of your way to kill them, but don't help them. Don't give them food. Don't give them water. Let nature take its course. But a number of these guys didn't. They were hundreds of miles, thousands of miles from Berlin, and they were in command of their own U-boats, and they were, you know, they would do what they thought was right.
Yeah, I thought the most interesting exchange was between a U-boat officer, and he was actually in America. Like, he lived in America before the war, lived in New York City, and he was a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. And he asked the Merchant Marine, like, how are the Dodgers doing?
Right. It's just an extraordinary story. And I also like the one, there's a, you read this too, where there's one of the guys, one of the U-boat commanders hands over a big 10-gallon jug of drinking water, and along with some cigarettes and some canned French cookies and everything. And before he gives him the jug of drinking water, he squeezes fresh limes into the water to introduce vitamin C into the water to fortify these castaways in the lifeboat against scurvy, a vitamin deficiency disease, in the event their lifeboat ends up having to be at sea for a long time. So some of the stories are just, but you know, again, there are other guys who are just utterly ruthless. And there was one guy who would sink ships, and he would approach the men in the lifeboats and subject them to political tirades against President Roosevelt for getting the U.S. involved in war. He'd say, don't ask me for drinking water, ask Roosevelt. He's the one that put you in this situation. And he wasn't entirely wrong.
We're going to take a quick break for your word from our sponsors. If you've been thinking about starting a website, whether you're a photographer, want to show off your portfolio, or you're a small business owner and need a web presence, check out Squarespace. You can get a great looking website without having to know any coding whatsoever, no HTML, no CSS, and you can create a stunning website, all with just the click of a mouse. They've got lots of templates for different needs. So if you're a photographer, they got a standard template for that, and you can customize it the way you want. And if you're a small business owner, they have a template for that, and you can customize it however you want. And again, it works on any device, desktop, mobile, laptop, whatever. They've got 24/7 customer support, so if you ever run into any problems, you can always reach out to them and get an answer right away. So yeah, it's a great deal. I got an offer for you if you want to try this out at a discount. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter offer code ARTOFMAN at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase. So yeah, again, free trial at squarespace.com. And when you make your first purchase, just use code ARTOFMAN at checkout to get 10% off. Also buy 5-4 Club. If you hate shopping because it takes too much time and honestly, it's kind of confusing, you're going to love 5-4 Club. For just $60 a month, they're going to send you a box of exclusive clothing that would usually retail for $120. And the clothing they send you is all going to fit together. These are outfits that you can start wearing immediately. And best of all, as you continue with 5-4 Club and continue to get boxes, the clothes they send you, they're going to work together so you can build a versatile wardrobe without really having to think about it. It's all autopilot. When you sign up for 5-4 Club, you tell them your style. If you're a classic guy, a mix, fashion forward, casual. And then after that, it's autopilot. I'm a classic guy, so I've been getting a lot of like Henleys. Starting getting into some shorts now that look really great. If you want to try 5-4 Club out, I got an offer for you. Go to 54club.com and use promo code manliness at checkout for 50% off your first box. Again, 54club.com, promo code manliness at checkout for 50% off your first box. Now back to the show.
So let's talk about the title of your book, The Matthews Men. The reason why you call it The Matthews Men is there was a county in Virginia called Matthews County that produced a ton of merchant mariners, and a lot of them were involved in this war, this U-boat war. Why did this particular county in Virginia produce so many mariners and that went on to go fight or, you know, take part in World War II?
Well, Matthews County had been producing mariners, you know, been like a cradle of sea captains and merchant mariners since before the American Revolution. Matthews is a beautiful place. It's a tiny, isolated community on the shore of the, clinging sort of to the shore of the Chesapeake Bay. And there's very little in Matthews. It's not on the way to anywhere. There's no big employers there, and job opportunities have always been very scarce there. You were either a fisherman, a waterman, as we call them in that area, or you were a farmer, or you went to sea. And going to sea, you know, all of these men grew up around the water. They all knew how to handle boats, you know, since they were little kids. So they were natural mariners, and they naturally gravitated toward the merchant marine because it was a business where you didn't need a lot of formal education, and you could. But if you worked hard and you knew your stuff, you could rise to the top of your profession. And that was a tradition in Matthews. And some families, you know, that was it. Your birthright was to become a sea captain. Your father had been one, your grandfather, maybe your great-grandfather. So it was always part of the Matthews, just part of what the community did. And when World War II came, there were a lot of these guys that had been in the merchant marine for a long time. And the war created such a demand for mariners that even the guys who were fishermen or were farmers, there were all these opportunities. The merchant marine needed men, and anybody who knew a bow from a stern just about could get a job. And there were some companies even that would go out of their way to hire Matthews men because they had a reputation as great seamen. So Matthews was, one Matthews guy put it, he said, you know, we've been doing this for a long time, and when the war came, we just kept doing it, and the torpedoes just got in our way for a while.
So you mentioned that, you know, in some families in Matthews, it was like a birthright. That's what you did. And so you talk about, you follow several families throughout the book, but there's one family, the Hodges family, that produced a ton, like a lot of merchant marine. How many men served in the U.S. merchant marine from the Hodges family during World War II?
Well, there were, six of the seven brothers were in the merchant, were on ships during there was the father, Captain Jesse. He was the patriarch of the family. He was a captain of an ocean going tug. And all seven of his sons went to sea. One of them got hurt and had to go ashore. But several of the seven brothers' sons maybe a dozen Hodges, and you know, the Hodges' daughters would marry mariners. So maybe 15 members of the Hodges family were at least were on merchant ships during World War II.
And did any of them die at the hands of a U-boat?
Yes, two of them were torpedoed within the space of 11 days.
Wow!
And a couple of the others had very close calls. You know, and they were out there the whole time, and they were on special missions. And they went to one of them went to Murmansk, which was the worst, you know, the most notorious run, the trip to northern Russia. And others were, you know, they were in the Med. They were one of them went to the a very dangerous mission to supply, to send supplies to the island of Malta. And so the Hodges were all over the place during the war, many of them in the Caribbean.
And are there any descendants of the Hodges family that are still mariners, or did that sort of dry up, that family tradition?
There are descendants now who are in the, it's interesting because the merchant marine, as far as cargo ships, is greatly reduced, but there is still a number of merchant mariners who are in tugboats. And there are several members of the Hodges family who are tugboat captains or tugboat officers, and they're well known in the tugboat community now. So they've sort of moved on from cargo ships to tugs. And I guess the situation's changed. The tradition is still alive. And I interviewed a couple of the tugboat guys.
How many merchant mariners died during World War II? I think you mentioned it was had one of the highest casualty rates, correct?
Yes, there were roughly 9,300 of them. And that was a casualty rate. The only branch of the military that was even comparable was the U.S. Marines. And most of those deaths occurred in 1942, before the convoys were instituted here on the coast. So they were very much concentrated. But it was still dangerous to sail a cargo ship, even after the convoys were in place, because U-boats didn't quit attacking. And once they got into the Med, and the German bombers would attack them, and before the Med, these men were killed by bombers.
And what happened to the merchant mariners after the war? They're sort of in an interesting position. They weren't officially sailors or soldiers in the Navy or whatever, but yet they were still taking part in the war in a very on the front lines. Did they enjoy any of the veterans' benefits or that happened after World War II, or were they sort of left to their own devices?
They were kind of left out. The mariners did not. They didn't enjoy it. They weren't welcomed home as heroes. They weren't really welcomed home at all. They didn't come home. When the war ended, they were still on their ships. They were bringing troops home, and after that, they were hauling materials over to Europe and people over to Europe to rebuild the cities that had been shattered by the war. And ultimately, they even brought home the American dead, whose families wanted them reinterred in the U.S. soil. So they were basically still out there. They weren't there for the ticker tape parades down the main boulevards of the United States. And they didn't have a lot of powerful friends in Congress. Franklin Roosevelt had been a big proponent of theirs, but he died before the war ended. And he had asked Congress, to provide for these guys, do something for them. But Congress did not, and they were left out of the GI Bill, left out of really most of the benefits that veterans had, and they got some, you know, decades later. But by then, a lot of them had died or were pretty far along in age. And there have been efforts from time to time, and there are some now in Congress to recognize what they did, and either give them some honorary, recognition or give them some money. But that legislation never really seems to go anywhere, which I think is a shame.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think you mentioned that they finally were able to go to the veterans' hospitals. But this was like by the time they were like, these guys were in their 80s or 90s.
Yeah, I mean, they that was a little earlier they got to do that. And that was help to some of them. But it was, you know, it was a big difference to that versus when you're a young man to come home and have opportunities. And so it was pretty late in the game. And now they are. Now most of these guys are in their late 80s and early 90s. If somebody did give them some money, you know, it's not like they're going to buy sports cars or get scammed on the internet. You know, they might fix the roof or start a college fund for their grandchildren or something. But most of these guys, at least the Matthews men, gave up long ago, expecting the government to come back and say, "Hey, you know, we should have done better by you. We're sorry. Here's something." You know, they don't even. I don't even know if they even think that. Some of the guys I talked to said that the one thing they would like is for just people in general to know what they did. One of the guys told me, he said, maybe after your book comes out, maybe my grandkids will believe that I did. You know, my stories will believe that I did something useful during the war, but that, you know, that the time for even that is growing very short. When I started working on this book in earnest in 2011, there were maybe 12 or 15 old Matthews men who sailed against the U-boats living in and around Matthews. And today there's maybe five or six. And one of my favorite Matthews men, Bill Callis, who's in the book, and he was just a real character. And the last time I interviewed him, he told me, he said, "You want me to read this book you're writing? You better hurry up and get it written." And a couple of weeks later, I went to his funeral.
Yeah, that's one of the sad things is that we're losing these World War II veterans and individuals who took part in the war like every day. I mean, it's they're shrinking.
We are really pretty much approaching the time where any stories about World War II will have to be told through documents rather than talking to people.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's so important, like what you're doing and what other World War II historians are doing, is getting these stories and talking to these men directly so we can get them before they're gone. So I commend you for that. What's the status of the Merchant Marine today? Does it still exist?
It does. It's sort of a complicated issue. The Merchant Marine, the U.S. Merchant Marine is, and I know this because I worked at Maersk, one of a U.S. subsidiary of Maersk, which is one of the biggest shipping companies in the world. But today, the U.S. Merchant Marine, it's much more expensive to operate a ship flying the U.S. flag and employing American mariners than it is ships from many foreign countries. The pay is higher. Some of these mariners from third world countries will work for just a fraction of what the Americans will. And the foreign flag ships, they don't have the regulatory and the legal requirements that American ships do. So in international trade today, the big freighters, in order to compete for business, because that's, you know, it's a business, it's the shipping business. In order to compete, they have to be subsidized by the government. They have to get, they have to be subsidized to keep these ships operating, or they have to be guaranteed cargo by the government. And there's always a lot of debate in Congress about whether this is a good idea. How much do we really need to do this? But the best argument is that during war, the military relies on these guys. You know, if it's an American ship, these American ships, they will, and the country needs them, they'll drop whatever they're doing. They'll drop off whatever commercial cargo they've got at the nearest port and report wherever they're told and start hauling war supplies. If we need to take whatever, we need to take it. They've been doing this, you know, really in all the conflicts we've had, even the most recent ones. So the nation has an interest in maintaining a merchant marine that it can count on to do this. And there's a debate going on right now in Congress as to how much of this we should do.
So yeah, it's in a national security interest. We should keep this going, yeah. Probably.
Yeah, and if we didn't have one, then we wouldn't be. Right now, the question is, do we have enough American U.S. flag ships and American merchant mariners to do what we need to do to haul war cargo or military cargo for longer than a few months if we get into a conflict somewhere where we have to put large numbers of troops overseas.
Yeah, I think you mentioned there's like 11,000 registered mariners in the country, but there's only 5,000 jobs available or something like that. It's a competitive job field.
It is, and they're good jobs, but they're getting more and more scarce. And again, the government, most of the cargo ships engaged in international trade now that are U.S. flagged are there because they're subsidized by the U.S. government for the reason that, as you say, for national security.
Well, William, this has been a fascinating conversation. We really just scratched the surface of the book, and there's so much more our listeners could, if they want to dive deeper into this topic. Where can people learn more about your book?
On my website, which is williamgerouxe.com. That's WILLIAMGEROUX.com is a good place to start.
Excellent. Well, William Giroux, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
My guest today is William Giroux. He's the author of the book, The Matthews Men, Seven Brothers in the War Against Hitler's U-Boats. And you can find that on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. And be sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/Matthews. And that's Matthews with one T. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the show, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And as always, I appreciate your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.